This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In last month's budget, the Chancellor's decision to cut workers' national insurance contributions by a further 2p wasn't particularly remarkable. But Jeremy Hunt's suggestion that NI should eventually be scrapped altogether most certainly was. National insurance is usually thought of as the way we fund the state pension, so cutting it raises serious questions about the future of the pension. And that's even before you consider our ageing population. Are the rapidly rising costs of the current system sustainable for the retirees of tomorrow? And if not, what do we do about it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, how does the state pension system actually work? Who gets what? How much does it cost? And how's it paid for? Joining me in the briefing room are Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and Paul Lewis, financial journalist and presenter of Radio 4's Money Box. Paul Lewis, give us a quick history lesson. When was the state pension introduced and who was back then eligible to get it?
Well, the first payments were made on 1st of January 1909. It was introduced by Lloyd George. To get it, you had to be 70. There was a sort of means test that you didn't have to have sort of massive assets. And the best thing was you had to be an approved person. You had to go before a committee as a person of good character. You got 5 shillings a week, 25 pence, equivalent to about £25 or £30 now.
What was actually the purpose of that first state pension? What was it trying to do?
It was simply really to relieve poverty, the absolute complete poverty people might have if they were beyond the age when they could work. They had no family to support them or help them. Maybe they were very poor as well. And to reflect, I think, that people had worked all their lives and probably from 13 or 14 to the age of 70.
Can you just take us through how it developed in the early days after that?
Well, in the 1920s, it changed and it became a sort of contributory benefit where you had to pay. And the age then was brought down to 65 to qualify. And then there was the really revolutionary change that was decided on during World War II, really, and came into effect in 1948, when you had to have paid a certain number of national insurance contributions. And that was when the pension age was changed for women, reduced to 60, still 65 for men. And that system lasted almost unchanged, really, until 2016 with the new state pension.
Life expectancy back then was presumably, firstly when it started, but also just after the Second World War when it was more fully developed, was presumably far lower than it is now.
Yes, it was, and it's grown consistently since. And now, at 66, which is the age when you get the state pension, a woman can expect to live to the age of 87 and a man to the age of 85. So that's, you know, nearly, on average, 20 years on the pension. And you have a 1 in 4 chance of getting into your 90s. So, yes, life expectancy now is a lot longer than it was then.
Paul Johnson, who is eligible for a state pension today and how much is it currently?
Well, pretty much everybody who has been resident in the UK for a period of at least 35 years is now building up their entitlement to the state pension. So we don't quite have a pension which is just dependent on residence or citizenship. We still have this residual link to national insurance contributions, but it is increasingly residual. Because if you spent time unemployed or sick or looking after children, then you get credits towards your pension. So most people, when they get to age 66, are entitled to their £221.20 per week, which is the new state pension.
What is that as a percentage of full-time earnings?
It's about 30% or thereabout of median full-time earnings. That's at its highest level it's been for quite some time, partly because of this introduction of the new state pension in 2016, partly because of this thing called the triple lock.
I think you're going to have to remind us now exactly what the triple lock is.
But it's this slightly odd, shall we call it, system by which the pension goes up in line with whatever is higher each year, increases in earnings, increases in prices, or 2.5%. Now, the actual legislation says that it needs to go up in line with earnings, but the policy has been it needs to go up in line with the higher of those three. And that's essentially been policy since 2010. Now, it's strange because suppose earnings go up 6% this year and 0% next year. Prices go up 0% this year and 6% next year. Well, both prices and earnings will be 6% higher at the end of the period, but the pension will be 12% higher because you get the 6 and 6 each time. That's what's so bizarre about it. In the long run, it's not related really to anything.
Let's talk about how much this costs. Not where we get the money from. We'll do that in a moment. But how much does the state pension cost the government to provide each year?
Well, the state pension itself costs somewhere around £125 billion. At least that's what it cost last year. It'll probably cost another £10 billion or so in 2024-25. That's a pretty big chunk of money. We spend more, if you count it as a single bit of state spending, we spend more on the state pension than on anything else other than the National Health Service. It's worth saying we also spend another £30 billion or so on other benefits for pensioners. Some of them are getting means-tested benefits and housing benefits. Some of them will be on disability benefits of one kind or another. So whilst in 2023-24, the cost was about £125 billion for the state pension alone, it was well over £150 billion if you include other benefits.
Wow. And as a percentage of national income, what is it roughly?
That's about 5% or so of national income. So £5 in every 100 that the economy earns goes just on paying that state pension.
Paulus, can you take us through what actually pays for what?
National insurance is paid by everyone in employment who earns more than £12,570 a year. And it was 12% of the income over that. It was cut to 10% by the Chancellor in his autumn statement. That began in January. And it's falling again to 8% from April the 6th. So that's a big cut. That's actually a fall from 12% to 8% is a third off the amount of national insurance people are paying. And that money, and there's also national insurance paid by people who earn more than £50,270, they only pay 2%. And that all goes into what's called the National Insurance Fund.
The National Insurance Fund. Mm. I'm a pensionable age. I'm not sure I've even heard of this fund.
No, but it pays your pension if you're claiming it, David. The National Insurance Fund, people say to me, well, there is no fund. It's a myth. It's a myth in one sense. There isn't a pot of money with national insurance written on it that the money's put in. But just as there's a Ministry of Defence budget, you know, which the Ministry of Defence draws on to buy its weapons and pay its soldiers, it's all government money. But the National Insurance Fund is a statutory and separate fund of money, albeit the actual pounds are in the same pot as everything else. And when you pay in, it goes into, well, first of all, the NHS takes about 20% of what you pay in national insurance. It was about 33.5 billion last year went to pay the NHS. The rest of it, 144 billion, we'll say, went into the National Insurance Fund. And almost all of that, 95% of that, pays for the state pension.
Do you mind if I sort of...
No, Paul Johnson, please come in, because I know that you have a view on this.
I'm not going to disagree with Paul Lewis because, of course, what he's described is a true statement of the accounting mechanisms. But I think it's all sort of an unnecessary complication. I mean, if you increase or decrease national insurance contributions, that is going to make no difference to the amount that gets spent on the state pension and no difference to the amount that gets spent on the National Health Service. It's purely an accounting nonsense, I would say.
Which raises a question which we've got to deal with. So why cut it or why keep it in any shape or form at all? So the mythology I wanted to get at a little bit was the idea that somehow or other, the amount of money I've been paying in my contributions into the pot is what pays my pension.
Yes, no, this isn't true. I mean, it's true of personal pensions generally. It's certainly not true of national insurance. The amount of money that people in work are paying in national insurance pays today's pensioners. So if you're of pensionable age, and I'm certainly of pensionable age and getting my state pension, that's being paid by people at work today who are under pension age, because of course once you reach 66 you don't pay national insurance on your wages, strangely. So it's a current thing, and I think the confusion arises because you have to in a way earn your state pension by paying a certain number of years of contributions. So there are two completely separate functions for those contributions you pay. One is you buy a ticket for your state pension, and the other is the money you pay goes to all the old folk like me as you pay it. And people confuse those two things and they think it's my money, I've earned it. People say to me, it's not a benefit. It is a benefit. Legally, it is a benefit.
If there's a shortfall in this supposed fund, then presumably it's simply made up for in general taxation.
Yes, there is a provision for a Treasury grant, it's called now, that the National Insurance Fund at the moment has a massive surplus. In the past tax year, 23-24, it paid out £11.5 billion less than it took in. So its surplus grew to something like £84 billion. Over the next few years, that's predicted to come down, and particularly because national insurance have been cut and now has been cut again. So that will come down.
Well, that's very interesting. And I suppose it brings me on to my next question, Paul Johnson, which is, what do we know about the future costs of providing the state pension?
Well, one of the problems is that if we carry on with the triple lock, it's really quite hard to know. It depends on what that relationship between inflation, earnings increases and 2.5% will be. So if we carry on with the triple lock, that could increase spending by a lot, a couple of percent of national income by 2050, or by very little as a fraction of national income by 2050. It also depends on decisions that we make about the state pension age. Now, state pension age is rising in 2 or 3 years' time. It's also going to rise again in the 2040s, but it might rise in the late 2030s. So that's a decision that this government has kicked down the road until after the election. So the cost will depend very significantly on the rate at which the pension rises and on the rate at which the state pension age increases. It is very hard to see a world in which we're not spending at least 5% more of national income on a combination of pensions, health and social care in 20 odd years' time. And 5% of national income is a lot. I mean, that is getting on for 150 billion of taxes and spending in today's terms.
I want to go back for a moment to the question of the contribution that the state pension makes to the well-being of current pensioners and pensioners in the immediate future. Just take hypothetically, if someone wanted to buy a pension of the equivalent value of the full state pension, what would it cost them to do it?
The estimate I read just this week from an investment company that it would cost £250,000 to have the equivalent of the state pension that went up with the retail prices index. It is an awful lot of money, far more than most people have. But that's what it's worth, and people should recognise that. They might think, well, I can't live on it. But, you know, it would cost you a quarter of a million to buy it.
That takes me really to my next question, Paul Johnson, which is, what can we say about the importance of the state pension to people's finances in later life? And I suppose what I'm asking is, what percentage of people's income actually comes from the state pension once they're of pensionable age?
Well, it's very important for everyone. If you're in the sort of lower sort of fifth of pensioner incomes, then it's about 3/4 of your total. But even for the richest fifth, it's at least 1/4 of their income. So it's very important for everyone. And of course, because it's this largely universal non-means tested benefit, it's something that's really important for people to build on. And it's, as Paul was saying, it's worth 250 million quid to start with.
Paulus, is it fair to say, you hear this almost in the form of a complaint, a generational complaint, that most pensioners today own their homes outright. In other words, they don't actually have housing costs to pay.
The majority certainly own their homes. I think 70% own their homes. And for most of them, the mortgage has been paid off. But a growing number of pensioners, and by which I mean people who reach state pension age 66, are either renting or still paying a mortgage, because mortgages have got so expensive recently that, you know, people have bought long-term mortgages so that they will be paying that mortgage into retirement.
Now, that is current pensioners. So the next question comes, what about the next lot of pensioners coming up behind? Are they in the same situation?
It's going to be very, very different. If you talk to people in their 40s now, who I suppose are the next generation of pensioners, and apologies to all the 40-year-olds listening, you think I'm the next generation of pensioners, they are going to be in a very different position on the whole. They will not have the same level of home ownership. The ones that do, of course, will be the elite of the pensioners in 20 or 30 years' time. But it will be a very different proportion of people, and I think that is going to be another problem that future politicians and indeed future voters have to deal with.
Paul Johnson.
Yeah, I think that's a really important. If you look at today's pensioners, they broadly speaking look okay. I've got a sense that politicians are thinking, well, this isn't a problem we need to worry about. But the problem with pensions is that you need to sort them out at least a generation ahead of when people actually hit pension age.
Paul Johnson there with Paul Lewis. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about the danger from synthetic opioids, the one about what the European Court of Human Rights actually does, and the two on the upcoming elections in India and South Africa. Right, back to pensions, and now I want to explore how we might deal with the future challenges that the pension system faces. Joining me in the briefing room are Steve Webb, formerly Minister for Pensions and partner with pension consultants Lane, Clark and Peacock, and Claire Barrett, consumer editor at the Financial Times and presenter of the FT's Money Clinic podcast. Steve Webb, we heard earlier from Paul Johnson that the cost of the pension system and dealing with health and social care could between them take another 5% of national income in the years ahead. Now, that depends on some variables, and we should take the most obvious one first, which is changing the state pension age. As far as you understand it, what are currently the plans for alterations in the state pension age, and what have been discussions about it?
So we start from a situation where men and women now get a pension at 66, which obviously is an increase of 6 years for some women in fairly recent history. We already know we'll move to 67 during the next parliament, so by 2028, the pension age for everyone will be 67. The law of the land says we have to get to 68 in 2046. Now, that feels like a long way away. And so the government's done two state pension age reviews, one headed by John Cridland, the former business leader, one by Baroness Neville Rolfe more recently. Both of them suggested moving the 68 forward to the late 2030s, but neither has been legislated for. And I think what may be the outgoing government, we don't know, thought that's one for the next lot.
Claire, is that your understanding as well?
I think what's clear is that the system as it is currently can't go on without big changes being made, either to the age at which people get their state pension or the level of state pension to which they receive. Something that's talked about a lot is whether the state pension should be means tested, because at the moment you'll get the same amount depending on what you've paid in if you're somebody on a very low income or somebody who is a millionaire. Now, is that a fair state to be in when so many people are purely reliant on the state pension to get by, whereas others have built up a level of savings whereby the state pension isn't so crucial, but nevertheless, it is something that they're expecting to get because they've paid into the system for so many years.
Sticking with, for the moment, with the eligibility question, what I'd like to know, Steve Webb, is how difficult it is actually to do this. And one of the most recent reminders we've had of some of the problems that can accrue from this has been what has been called the WASPI women, which I have to say is a situation that baffles me.
The background to that was legislation as long ago as the mid-1990s, prompted by a court judgment, which said that men and women had to have the same pension age. And back then, women drew a pension at 60, men at 65. And that legislation itself was perfectly sensible legislation. It changed nothing for 15 years. And then said from 2010 to 2020, there would be this gradual process of equalisation. And I think if people had known about that legislation and acted upon it, we probably wouldn't have had this issue at all. But what the Ombudsman found recently is that in the early 2000s, 2000s, the Department for Work and Pensions did research, found out a significant number of women didn't know about the changes and took no action. And so what the Ombudsman said is, Parliament can pick pension ages, that's not my job, I'm not going to try and reverse these changes, but if the Department knew that people weren't aware, didn't tell them until right on the cusp of the changes, then that may have caused them distress, inconvenience at the very least, quite separate to the fact they had to wait longer for their pension, and that's really what the focus is on now. But it's a reminder that you are affecting millions of people when you change pension age, that people expect notice. And that's the difficult politics of this. Because if I stand up and say the pension age is going to be 68 or even 69 or 70, which has been floated in some government reports, but I'm not going to do it till 2050 or something, I get no money to spend, but I get all the political flack for raising pension ages. So that's one of the reasons why it keeps getting kicked down the track.
Claire.
Women have a particular problem when it comes to pensions. Now, a lot of this stems from the gender pay gap, which everyone will have heard of. Fewer people have heard of the gender pensions gap. But of course, because pensions are a part of our pay, women might work part-time or work fewer hours, raising a family, looking after elderly relatives. So their pensions at the age of retirement tend to be substantially less than the average man's. Overlay onto the top of that, that both genders are probably under-saving for retirement. But
can we give it absolutely clear? We're not just talking about the state pension here. We're talking about all pension
sources. All pensions. So workplace pensions, private pensions. And the reason for that, put simply, is caring responsibilities. Now, there are lots of grannies acting as unpaid nannies in the country at the moment. We can see that because childcare is so expensive, and it's something that women are doing more than men. But even before that, when you have a family, you raise children, it's more often the woman's salary that will take the hit, either because they work part-time or their lifetime earnings are affected by having to provide care and raise a family. So there is this imbalance within the system. And then with the WASPI women, people having less of a pension, more reliant on the state pension, and then finding out that they're not going to get that until much later than they had banked on, when it could be the only pension income that they have or the predominant source of their retirement funding. That's why this is such a huge issue for women.
Let's move on to the question of the value itself. Now, obviously, one way in which you can try and reduce the amount of money you have to spend is reducing the value of the pension itself. Steve Webb, what are the realities and the politics of allowing the value of the state pension to drop, let's say by getting rid of the triple lock, with the objective of having the cost being reduced?
I think we've seen the contrast. If you look at the period from 1980 to 2010, that 30-year period, the pension was linked purely to inflation. Didn't matter what's happening to wages or anything else, it was just inflation. And famously, in the year 2000, that formula generated a 75p pension rise, which created a furore at the time.
And that was poor old Gordon Brown.
It was, and therefore, the next year, they put a fiver on it. They didn't look at formulas or anything. There was an election year, 2001, blow the rules, we'll stick a fiver on it. That really, and that is the origin of the triple lock, funnily enough. That 75p that said you just can't give pensioners 75p is where this minimum 2.5% increase comes from. That's how it came about. I introduced that in 2010. Must admit, pleasantly surprised to see it still going in the mid-2020s, but it will be switched off at some point. There's no doubt about that. And at that point, there will probably be either a double lock, so better of prices and wages, or maybe just a link to wages or some fudge. But that is definitely one way they'll take some steam out of the future cost, because the current projections assume the triple lock carries on. So if you take that out and do something less generous, that's one way of easing the pressure.
Claire, you're nodding, but one of the consequences of this is that pensioners would get less money than they would otherwise receive. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, I think you've got two problems here. The first is that this system, as it carries on, everybody, all pensioners, are getting more money, and that in itself is unsustainable. But the second problem is, if you want to help those poorer pensioners with further additional welfare benefits, such as pension credit, which is designed to top up the incomes of the poorest pensioners, where do you put that dividing line? Where do you draw that distinction? Do you have a system in the future whereby, if you've already amassed quite a lot of your own pension savings through a company scheme or through private pensions or even ISAs, individual savings accounts, do you say to those people, well, you can't get your state pension or you can't get the full amount of your state pension until an older age? age? Do you have like a two-tier system? And those who are entirely reliant on the state pension and nothing else get more and do have an inflation-protected system like you would have with other benefits? Or do you means test the system and say you can only get it if you are the poorest?
Steve, to make an obvious point here, isn't there a disincentive for you to create more private pension if you know you're going to lose it off the state pension?
Absolutely. And I think in a country like the UK where we have voluntary pensions in private sectors, although you're automatically enrolled into a workplace pension, you can opt out. If you knew that if you saved in a private pension, the government would just give you less state pension, why would you bother? You'd be very tempted to spend the money on living now. And it's interesting that one country that does means test state pensions is Australia, which is a country that has compulsory private pensions. So you have to save.
Which brings us to that point precisely, which is, can you explain to us, Claire, what auto-enrolment is and what it seeks to do and why it might be some help for us in solving this conundrum?
It has been a fantastically successful policy. When you start a job working for a private sector company, you are automatically enrolled into the company pension scheme. You don't have to opt in. It's done for you. If you want to leave, then you can, but you've got to fill in some paperwork. So it nudges people into pension saving, which is something that they've never learned about in school or university. They're unlikely to understand that it's free money. Free money from your employer, because they have to make a minimum contribution, and free money from the government, because they have to give you tax relief and your investments can grow tax-free throughout your working life, which could be 40, maybe even 50 years if they raise the state pension age. So it's a great thing, and it's pushed around 10 million people into pension savings. They do want to extend it. It hasn't helped low-income women who work part-time much because they don't meet the minimum income threshold. They would quite like to start for younger workers. However, lots of employers only pay the bare minimum that the government demands. And there is widespread ignorance, I think it's fair to say, amongst the workforce that different private sector employers may well offer enhanced pension contributions or the bare minimum. The only way you can really find out this information is by asking at a job interview, because companies don't generally make this public knowledge. Well, people who've read my book or listen to my podcast certainly do, because it could be 10% of your salary. It could be less than 3%. It's a really big difference. And the key point here is that pensions are a part of pay. We don't understand enough about them in this country, and their value to us in retirement is only going to be greater in the future as the state pension likely recedes.
If I were in my 30s and 40s now, what attitude should I take towards whether the pension system has got my back, Steve?
I'm not one of these people who thinks there won't be a pension in the future. There are so many pensioners who all turn out and vote. A government who said we're going to take it away, or indeed take it away in 10 years' time, would never get elected. So I think there will be a pension, but it's probably going to be less generous in the future. So you need to recognise that the buck stops with you ultimately. Hopefully the government will do more on your behalf to get you in a good place. But essentially you do need to, if you've got the money, if you're in a job, to be setting money aside. And particularly when you've got a pay increase, to allocate some of that for your future self. Because if you don't, the government will probably only be giving you a minimum level of support.
Claire.
I think the state pension is going to change in future years. We don't know how much it will change, but what will not change is our need for money to support us in our retirement. We don't know what level of state pension that we might expect to rely on, but what we do know is those who only rely on the state pension and have nothing else, we can see in society now, have a very challenging time compared to those who put away even quite small sums of money consistently through their working lives and now have more options in their 60s and 70s.
Claire Barrett there with Steve Webb. My thanks to them and to Paul Johnson and Paul Lewis. And my conclusion, governments need to plan for our futures, and so do we. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Drew Hindman. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me. We are the comedy show that takes history seriously, and I'm thrilled to say we have a brand new live episode to finish the series. It's all about the life and music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. I was joined by the comedian David O'Doherty, the historian Dr. Hannah Templeton, and the BBC Concert Orchestra, all 54 of them, and their conductor, Gavin Sutherland, as we played songs and music from Mozart's life, as well as telling jokes and having a lovely time learning about him. It's one of our best ever episodes, and I'd love you to hear it. You can hear it on BBC Sounds. Just type in You're Dead to Me.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.